This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Listeners, this week, Rabia here, and I am here this week with contributing host, Siraj Hashmi. Hey, Siraj.
Hey, how you doing, Rabia?
I'm good. We haven't talked in a while.
It has been a minute. I think the last time I chatted with you was when news was coming down the pipeline about Adnan.
So, Siraj, how have you been?
I'm good. You know, the summer's been pretty hot. If you've been around D.C., we're getting a lot of heat waves. But it's finally breaking. But everything in Washington remains hot, especially with the current political dynamic.
Well, before we get into all of that, how was your 4th of July?
It was great, you know, celebrating America, hug the flag in true Donald Trump fashion. You know, I've been on Atkins lately because I'm trying to diet.
You don't need Atkins.
I know. Some people say I don't need to lose weight, but, you know, that's because I'm always wearing clothes. You know, I'm trying to get that beach bar ready. And, you know, sometimes you got to cut, you got to try to get that six pack back.
Yeah. So no potato salad for you in the fourth, huh?
No. It's been all protein and no carbs. Very low carb diet.
How did you fare during the Second Civil War?
I did well, except for my dog, Ernie, my little long haired chihuahua who stabbed me with a musket. You know, I'm good. How about yours? How'd your Second Civil War go?
It was quiet. I spent it mostly on the sofa. I refused to participate. For our listeners who might not be aware of what we're talking about, and I wonder if people off of Twitter have any idea like what's going on.
Oh, it's got to be a pure Twitter thing. Like, people probably don't know about this at all if it's off Twitter.
Yeah, I think it is a pure Twitter thing. So Alex Jones, our friend, the crazy ass Alex Jones, and I just don't understand how this man does not get arrested for inciting like yelling fire in a theater type of violence.
First Amendment, Rabia, respect it.
What did you say? This is beyond the First Amendment. So he put together this video, you know, he has his shows and stuff, where he, I think it was like a week before the 4th of July, he was just like, well, the liberals are organizing and ready to launch the second civil war on, I think, the 4th, he said, right?
July 4th.
Yeah. So it was a surprise to me. I had not gotten the memo. And that just caused this, you know, massive Twitter craze. Hashtag Second Civil War, Civil War, Second Civil War letters. The letters were, you know, kind of like the old Civil War letters, but not, you know, it was funny. But at the same time, you know what? I feel like it was also a little bit scary because I'm like,
well, if somebody actually takes it seriously.
That, and also I sometimes wonder if that's not where we're headed, I'll be honest.
I mean, like, Alex Jones is a known grifter. So like anything he says, yeah, you know, I mean, like, on a serious note, he is a grifter. On a personal note, I think he is one of the greatest people to ever have lived, and I hope he gets nominated to the Supreme Court because that just shows how truly great the times we're living in right now.
I know you don't mean any of that, and maybe you are suffering from heat stroke.
No, actually, I thought about it just like, you know, what if he became the next Supreme Court justice? I would have to quit my job to clerk for him because that's how great of a job that would be. Like, just think about his judicial philosophy and legalizing gay frog marriage.
Legalizing what?
Legalizing gay frog marriage. I can't tell you how many times Alex Jones has gone on about gay frogs. It's about time we bring on the Supreme Court justice.
You know, I'm actually glad I don't know much about that. I don't have time for the Alex Jones rabbit hellhole.
All his conspiracy theories are just absolutely amazing because you're just like, how much weed does this man smoke? And I really want to try some of it.
Oh, no.
It can't be the weed, dude. There are plenty of people who are like always on the weed. But this guy is just...
He says he tests it once a year to test its potency, like the cops do. Not even joking. Not even joking. He said that.
Truly, him and Ann Coulter, I feel like, are true cancers in our society. But I want to talk a little bit. I want to move on for a second since we both survived the Second Civil War and, you know, and had relatively nice protein-packed 4th of Julys about another kind of heat that's coming down in D.C., and that is heat on Trump administration. I keep hearing stories, including today, where like Trump staffers go, I don't know to what extent they're kind of like hyping it up to, you know, to gain sympathy, but it seems like it's a thing now. You know, Trump staffers are, they'll go to a grocery store, they'll go to a, you know, bar to pick up some sushi like Stephen Miller did, go to a grocery store and and getting berated by the public or by proprietors or by, I mean, this is, what do you think about this and the whole question of civility on these issues?
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, I respect everybody's right to get in people's faces and tell them their opinions when they're in the private domain. I am one of those people, however, who always likes to let famous people or people who are in politics just live their lives, because I am so insignificant to them. No matter what I say to them, if it's like on a negative or critical note, they're not going to like actually legit hear me out. It's only going to reinforce their position. So, you know, on that level, like, I would critique the people actually getting in these, in like Stephen Miller's face or Kellyanne Conway's face or even Mitch McConnell's face, because it just, you know, I don't think it actually moves the needle in one way or the other. I think it probably just reinvigorates them or reinforces their position. And, you know, the whole civility debate that we're having, like, it's not a debate, because it's, we're only figuring out ways to kind of go lower than each other. And I think a lot of the public berations.
Really? I don't know. I feel like liberals will have a really hard time going lower than Nazis.
The fact that they're not Nazis, though, is what's kind of pushing back.
I mean, there are some. There are actual Nazis running
not
as
actual
Republicans.
Nazis. No, they're Republicans who differ on policy. And if, you know, like Stephen Miller's policy, I'm not a huge fan of the nuclear option policy of separating families. However, I will understand that there are families that come into the country that aren't actually families, but are, you know, a human trafficking smuggler bringing in a bunch of unaccompanied children. Like, those people should absolutely be saved, particularly the children and not the human trafficker. And they should be, you know, obviously.
Well, we're going to get into, there's a lot of immigration related news, because that's, I feel like that's one of the most important focuses of this administration, is to really clamp down on immigration stuff. We'll get into that.
I know that's kind of tangential, but like, specifically, I mean, I just don't agree with the notion of calling everyone that you dislike or disagree with.
No. I'm not talking about Stephen Miller here. I'm talking about actual Nazis who are like running for different positions in the country. They're actually identify.
One in Illinois and then I believe one in Indiana.
They're white nationalists. I mean, you don't want to call them Nazis. That's fine. But these are people who are actual white nationalists who identify with white.
Yeah, so call them white nationalists.
Okay.
I'm just saying, words matter. If you're going to call them white nationalists, call them white nationalists. Don't call them Nazis, because we all know Nazis are German. And, you know, there are people who are neo-Nazis.
There's an American Nazi party. You know that, right?
Huh?
There's an American Nazi party. So Nazis don't have to be German. There are plenty of Nazis in this country who are self-professed Nazis.
I know that. I'm just saying, with respect to the actual Nazi party, mm-hmm. if you're trying to conflate the Nazi party with everyone in the White House or working in the Trump administration, that's just simply not true. I haven't heard anyone say they affiliate themselves with the American Nazi Party that works for the Trump administration. Now, if you want to talk about actual policy,
like, would you feel better if I just called them fascists? I'll just call them fascists. But let's I understand what you're saying. And I mean, we're getting like, this is like a real technical. I didn't, when I said that there's actual Nazis, I am referring to the people who, there are a couple of candidates who are actual white nationalists who are running as Republicans, and the GOP has to own it. Now, you don't think they're Nazis?
I don't think
the
GOP should own it. They should absolutely disavow them.
But exactly. Okay, so let's move on from there. We've got a lot to go through, because it's been 2 weeks of holy hell. but the point is, I'm keeping an eye on this, and honestly, I keep thinking, what would happen? And actually, you know, Scott Pruitt, right?
Yeah. That was a year ago.
That, I mean, right. And so it's like, well, he was approached by that one mom. I don't know. When was that? How long ago was that?
That was like a week, at least maybe a week to 10
days. Yeah. So this mother holding a like infant approaches him in the restaurant and is like, you really should resign. And he did. What do you think? Yeah. What do you think precipitated the resignation now?
He was under investigation from the Inspector General of the EPA. Under, I think, 12 or either 14 federal investigations with respect to his behavior and possible ethics violations. And I think there was one that probably they probably saw coming down the pipeline. And I think he probably resigned to avoid further embarrassing not only himself, but also the Trump administration, which, if you could think about it, the Trump administration having to deal with an embarrassment, that seems like kind of a interesting point to make, considering the fact that a lot of people think every day is an embarrassment for this country.
I know.
But yeah, no, with respect to Scott Pruitt's behavior, I mean, there are just so many really good scandals and dubious behavior that he kind of just engaged with. I think he just got tempted by the power. He acted like a kid in a candy shop and didn't act like he had been there before. And what's your favorite Scott Pruitt scandal off the top of your head?
You know, for me, I think it's all the security-related stuff, whether it's like the setup he has to get in and out of his actual office, that phone booth, the tactical pants, the security detail. I just really want to know, like, I feel like you have to be some high-level mafia king to need that level of protection. I just don't understand why the head of the EPA
I think my favorite one is helping out his wife and trying to get her a job. And kind of using his office and using resources and aides to try to lobby other organizations to get her a job. So, like, he reached out to the CEO and president of Chick-fil-A, Dan Cathy, right, and tried to set up a meeting, which actually didn't go through, but to try to get his wife a job as a franchise owner of Chick-fil-A, which would have been absolutely hilarious.
But, you know, here's what I don't understand. Anybody can apply. I mean, like, it's like any kind of franchise. Why wouldn't he just go the normal route and have her apply as a franchiser?
I think the story behind it is that she was filling out an application for it and never finished. And then he just tried using his aides and government resources to get her a franchise.
I mean, the list is very long with this guy.
I'm just sad that we no longer get any more Scott Pruitt scandals.
Oh, it's not over. His whole life is like, I think, one long con. I think he's going to move on and see who else he can suck dry.
I mean, if he's doing it in the private sector, you know, then that's one thing. But if he's doing it on the taxpayer dime, that's why we take issue with it.
Let me tell you guys something. Last year, after I had my baby, I spent maybe a little more time than I was supposed to wearing the maternity pants that I had bought all through the pregnancy because, well, they're just really comfortable. I finally got weaned off when I got my first pair of Beta brand yoga dress pants. That's right. It's a dress pant yoga pant. All of those words go together. They are a dress pant on the bottom, beautiful, professional. You can wear them outside, go to the office in them, rock them in a meeting, and they are yoga pants on top. It is a party on top. Nice and comfy. The pair I got, well, they're black, sleek, beautiful, like just quality fabric that just is so comfortable. I can be in them all day and not feel exhausted by the end of my workday. And if you like different cuts, they've got it all. They've got boot cut, straight leg, crop, leggings, different colors, black, navy, gray, khaki. I'm going to get some more because, believe me, I need the party on top and business on the bottom pants in every color possible. They're seasonal, and they've also got limited edition colors that they release every month. They've got selections for all shapes and sizes. They even have these beautiful features that you will find on normal dress pants, like belt loops, a little button in the front, faux zipper and pockets, and these dress pant details. So do not walk, run to get your very first pair of Beta brand dress pant yoga pants. All you gotta do is visit betabrand.com and use our code 45th to get 20% off your pants. Millions of women agree these are the most comfortable pants you will ever wear to work. That's betabrand.com, BETABRAND.com, and use our code 45th and get 20% off your dress yoga pants today. There was also, actually, I'm not prepared to talk about it, but if you are, we can talk about it. He left the administration, but we have an addition, right? The Fox executive who joined communications team.
Yeah, Bill Shine. He joined the White House within the last week, focusing on communications, and he was fired from Fox News for whatever his role may have been involved with the Roger Ailes scandal, the sexual harassment, and sexual assault allegations made against him, as well as other Fox personnel like Bill O'Reilly. I'm not 100% sure what his role was at Fox News with respect to those particular allegations, but my understanding of it is that he somewhat turned a blind eye, or he didn't do enough to end it or prevent it, and that's why he was ousted. And, I mean, he works for the White House now. I don't know what really to say about it. As I hope he doesn't ignore it again.
He certainly doesn't come to the position with a great record. And have you been reading about his wife, which is an interesting...
I did hear about his wife tweeting out some racist things. And
I mean, it's not that she was just Darla Shine and his wife. She's a former TV producer. And she wrote a book called The Happy Housewives about the joys of being a stay-at-home mom. Great for her. But she has blogged and tweeted some really kind of gross stuff. You know, she's complained about, as a white woman, why she cannot use the N-word. Defends a Confederate flag. She is a complete Islamophobe.
I mean, look, she's not working for the White House. I understand it probably says a lot about Bill Shine's character that he's still married to her.
Well, I don't know about his character. I feel like they probably, you know, a lot of married couples kind of like fall in the same ideological.
Oh, no, I'm not rejecting that premise at all. I think that's highly possible that he probably shares maybe some of those views. I don't know if it's all of it, but at the same time, I mean, he's kind of working in a White House where, you know, he may not be the only one who shares those kind of views.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think John Kelly, I think the whole list of them all the way down. No, I think when it comes to this administration, Darla Shine's positions are like a perk and not a bug. They're a feature. Maybe he added it on his resume. Anyhow, there are way too many races that are too close to this administration or part of it. Well, anyhow, that was an addition to the White House in the past week. Moving on, there's been all kinds of, like, almost every couple of days, and I'm not following it too closely. I also don't understand, you know, economically, like, I'm not an economist or, you know, to understand, like, the real implications of a lot of the trade wars and the tariff stuff. But I do know this, that it seems like it's hitting a lot of the folks who actually were relying on Trump and his promises hard, including soybean farmers, when it comes to, like, China retaliating. And then we're getting news of companies that are like, actually, this is not working out for us, so we're leaving, like Harley Davidson.
Right. And then like Chick-fil-A and
did you say Chick-fil-A is leaving? No.
No, yeah. They're not leaving, but they're getting there's basically a tariff that's being slapped on maybe chicken. I can't recall. We have our own chickens. I don't know what the deal is. Maybe it's possible it was just a joke I was seeing online, and that's why I was referencing Chick-fil-A. But yeah, we absolutely know about Harley Davidson, and we know about the soybean tariffs. And it's interesting how some in his base are viewing it, because obviously if you implement tariffs strategically, obviously the goal here by President Trump is to basically renegotiate a new trade deal with a lot of these countries. You know, you have NAFTA between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, and then you have TPP, which President Trump withdrew from, and then we don't have a trade deal that has ever been – that there was never a trade deal that existed between the U.S. and China, and I think that's where Trump really has his eyes set on, because he's always campaigned on, you know, getting back at China for the trade imbalance. As of 2017, there was about a $375 billion trade imbalance that favors China at the moment. And you could look at things like intellectual property theft. You could look at things like cheap labor and cheap resources to build parts for products that ship overseas to the United States and we buy. And basically, I think what we're doing, or I think what Trump is doing, is to at least offset the trade imbalance that currently exists between the United States and China, but it's hurting a lot of working class people, a lot of farmers, and because China's basically implementing tariffs as a retaliation measure, and you have Canada doing the same as well.
Not aluminum. Just China. I mean, Harley is moving because of EU tariffs, right? Because Trump slapped the European Union with steel and aluminum tariffs, and so they retaliated, and now Harley's saying, well, it's going to cost over $2,000 per bike extra, more than we normally do to production. So they're moving not all of their production, but some of it.
Right, overseas. And so it's raising the cost on goods. I mean, that's kind of to be expected when it comes to tariffs. It's going to hurt the consumer in a way. It's going to hurt our pockets. And one of the worst things about it is that it offsets the benefits that were brought out by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the Trump tax cuts that a lot of his base were looking forward to. So, and it's not coming at a good time for him. It's not coming at a good time for the Republican Party, because if you know, we've only got about 4 months until the midterm elections happen. And Democrats have, I want to say, a pretty good chance of taking back the House. They have a decent chance of taking back the Senate. And if that's the case, I don't think you're just going to look at plenty of obstruction with respect to Trump. He's probably going to try to expand executive power even further unless Congress or the judicial branch checks him, which is highly possible. But, you know, the tariffs, that might be his undoing right there. And it's a weird place, I think, for him to be in, considering the fact that he's gotten this far and he shot himself in the foot this many times. And yet it might be one of his own policies that he's done to try to save America that might end up undoing his own presidency.
Yeah, I do agree that at least with his base, I mean, there's almost no amount of dystopian, terrible immigration stuff he could do that would like bother them. I think that's exactly what they
not
want.
Not even tariffs will undo his support. I mean, at least among his hardcore base. If you look at like independents who are suffering from this, then maybe they're probably on the fence about voting for someone probably who isn't a Republican. You got to look at some of these, you know, flyover states like Missouri, where Claire McCaskill is fighting for her life for the Senate, her Senate reelection campaign. You have Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota. You have Joe Manchin in West Virginia. I mean, a lot of red state Democrats, you know, Joe Donnelly in Indiana. There are so many things that they have to get right in order to win. And that's the only reason why I think there's not as good of a chance for Democrats to take the Senate, but they have a better chance at the House.
Yeah, well, if they take the House, I mean, they can't complete it, but they could begin impeachment proceedings, I suppose. I don't know if that would...
Yeah, it's not going to do anything. This is going to, you know, they're just going to waste political capital
by doing that. Well, Trump was, you know, he's upset about this Harley. He knows it makes him look bad. You're right. This could be the kind of stuff that makes him... Because the Harley-Davidson, that's a great American company, right? It's one of those great American companies that I think did support Trump.
Yeah, I mean, like, I when you think of, like, yeah. You know, all-American badass or, like, the stereotype American, if they're not riding a horse or riding a Harley.
Right. And Trump tweeted that my administration is working with other motorcycle companies who want to move into the U.S. Harley customers are not happy with their move. I wonder what other motorcycle companies, like what could replace Harley-Davidson?
Obviously, you have Toyota, you have Kawasaki.
Yeah, they're not exactly great American motorcycles. I mean, like
no, but I mean, like they produce motorcycles and I don't know if they produce like the kinds that Harley makes, but you know.
And they're foreign companies. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if he could steal one of those companies from a foreign country that, I mean, he'll have a lot to work with in saying we're bringing jobs back to the United States.
I think it'll be a tough sell. But so in immigration-related news, we've got a whole bunch of things. We got a story that came out that said that the United States, and this is, I think, truly shameful, in 2017 resettled less refugees, lower than any other nation in the world. That's how low our refugee resettlement has gotten, because basically the administration is not approving. They're just not taking, accepting refugee applications. They're just not accepting asylees and refugees. Another thing is Trump tweeted out, to my horror last week, a clear rejection of due process. He tweeted, law enforcement at the border is doing a great job, but the laws they're forced to work with are insane. When people with or without children enter our country, they must be told to leave without our country being forced to endure a long and costly trial. Tell the people out and they must leave just as they would if they were standing on your front lawn. Hiring thousands of judges does not work and is not acceptable. We are the only country in the world that does this. So I thought I'd talk about this a little bit to talk about kind of the reality of immigration court, because a lot of people are not familiar with it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to like dispute your expertise since you're an immigration attorney.
In all honesty, I I'm an immigration attorney, but I didn't practice a lot of removal. I've done a very little removal, and removal is what is now a deportation. It used to be called deportation. It's now called removal. But I'll keep calling it deportation. Everybody calls it deportation, but it's not deportation anymore. So basically the way it works is, first of all, let's get something straight. There are less than 350 IJs, which are immigration judges, in the entire country. Like about 345, 346. There's less than 350 immigration judges. Now, while they are called judges, they really are administrative officials working for the executive branch. They're not considered part of the judicial system. They're not counted. When you count the federal judges and state judges, they don't count amongst that. They are part of the Department of Justice. They're not judges in the way that we think of judges, like in a circuit court, or they're really, officials in the executive branch. Most people are referred to an immigration, that's how the terminology is, you're referred to an immigration court or an immigration judge when an officer, an immigration officer, denies your application. And he thinks that, okay, now you have no status, so you can be put in removal. Things are a little bit different at the borders, where people are being basically immediately detained and immediately referred to judges. And, you know, it's a different process than the regular process. But a couple of things that are important to know is that there's no right to counsel in immigration court. And I actually encourage folks who live in jurisdictions where an immigration court exists, you can just Google it. It's called the EOIR, which is the Executive Office for Immigration Review. Look for local EOIR courts. And as a member of the public, you can go and sit. You can sit and you can watch immigration proceedings. And I think it's really instructive to do so, because you're going to see how deeply people's lives are changed and impacted. But it's like it's a traffic court proceeding with much higher stakes. And like I said, you don't have a right to an attorney. So, and only about 15% of people are actually represented in immigration court. It's very low representation. And now what we're seeing is a lot of children, you know, a lot of these children who have been separated from the families are showing up. Like today I read a story about a one-year-old. I don't even understand. It's a joke. This is a farce. This is a mockery of the system. It's a mockery of our values. It's just, this baby has no, I have a 16-month-old, you know what I mean? So I know what it's like. I mean, they have no understanding of anything. Of course, the baby was playing with a ball. But anyhow, the other part of his tweet and the things that he keeps insisting, which is not true, he says no other country in the world has immigration judges. And technically that's true because they don't call them judges, but dozens of countries actually have a very similar immigration process in which their administrative officials who make the same kinds of decisions on asylee and refugee applications and all that stuff. They just have different titles. So it's kind of bullshit. There are about 5,000 immigrants who are enlisted as Army reserves and recruits. And apparently they joined with the promise that they would have a path to citizenship eventually. And they are now being discharged one by one. Apparently a few dozen have been discharged in the last few months.
I think there was a dispute in that story because they were saying discharge. But I think what actually happened in that story was that these individuals who are applying for U.S. military through their citizenship program, they have to go through a background check. And a lot of these recruits didn't actually pass their background check. And if they have basically a window, so you have like a 120-day window or a 6-month window, something like that. If you don't get your background check done within that particular period of time, then you can't serve. And therefore your opportunity to join the U.S. military in that citizenship program re-expires unless you reapply or go through some sort of appeal process. But I think that story has kind of in some ways not been fully accurate or fully true, because okay, there hasn't been that many. I think there have only been within the last year only 40 who actually were discharged after having served to an extent with the reserves or in active duty through that citizenship program for whatever reason, whether it's disciplinary, what have you.
So you're saying about 40 of those recruits have been discharged, but that's not related to the background check stuff. It's related to stuff, reasons we don't know.
Right. It could be, you know, disciplinary. It could be for any reason, you know, health, what have you. I'm just pushing back on that story because I read through it and I read other stories about it, and it's not 100% accurate.
I think we should be accurate, and I appreciate that. And I am going to do a little more digging on that. I think it's good to know that. And I completely agree, because, you know, there are a lot of stories, even the stories about detention facilities and the conditions and family detention and stuff. This stuff was taking place under Obama. This stuff was taking place before Obama. This is not new. It's just the
microscope has just been shifted onto a lot of these issues.
Yes and no. Yes, it has been, but that's also not it alone. I mean, Trump has issued a zero tolerance policy, which Obama did not have. The frequency at which, I mean, like the rates of detention are way, way higher. Just this past week, on a conference call with some senators, I think it was the HHS secretary, somebody said that since May, they have separated and detained 3,000 children just since May. So the numbers are kind of unprecedented. And I think that's what's alarming people, of course, along with the rhetoric. But I want to talk a little bit about a a court order that took place on June 26th, and I think that was during our break. So a court ordered that Trump, so there are about like 101 children being held under the age of five, as far as this court was aware. And I really think the numbers are probably not accurate. But anyhow, they ordered the administration to reunite them by July, I think 10th is their deadline. And so, you know, they've been frantically working, I guess, on doing this, but it's not going well because it seems like they didn't have a plan in place for reuniting folks. So this past Friday, the DOJ attorney, I mean the government attorney, Sarah Fabian, she told the court that they might need some additional time to track down a lot of the parents. Some of the parents had, parents of like 19 kids had already been deported. But the ACLU was representing on the other end, and the ACLU is like, yeah, we're here all weekend. We can just stay here and work through the weekend. And the judge was like, that's fine. Fabian was like, no, I got a dog sit in Colorado. So they were supposed to reconvene today. But so it was HHS Secretary Alex Azar admitted that 3,000 children have been taken from parents since May. Also, a couple of weeks ago, an assistant federal public defender told a federal court that her office tried and failed to match 38 adults who came to a hearing with 39 children that they were separated from, and they couldn't do it because records for nine of the adults couldn't be found. A program to track unaccompanied kids who arrived at the border wasn't designed to track the circumstances under which the kids were detained, so they're taking the kids, but the whatever system they're using to track them does not identify if they were separated from the parents or not, or if, like you said earlier, they came through with like human traffickers or arrived alone. And so they are going through 11,000 files for 11,000 children manually right now to try to figure out which child came in with a parent and who belongs to who.
That's remarkable. I'm in many ways very stunning, but also at the same time, it's just really sad to see. I mean, the real victims here are the children who are coming in who, you know, either they came through no fault of their own, they came with a parent, they came in through a smuggler, or they came in alone. And I understand with the respect for empathy, you know, a call for empathy to have for these children, absolutely should have it. I think we're getting lost a lot of the time in the debate over the actual policy of trying to avoid, you know, I can't back Trump's zero tolerance policy. Like, it's completely indefensible. At the same time, I can't say that all of these detention centers are a good thing, which happened under Obama or happening under Trump. I honestly, like, for you, Rabia, I mean, like, what is the solution here? What, like, do we just straight up? I know people have been calling for to abolish ICE. You can't actually do that.
No, you actually can. You know why? Because ICE didn't exist before 2009. I don't know, whatever the year was. There was a time. We had borders before ICE. We will have borders after ICE. The thing about ICE.
Well, we had INS beforehand. And that was, I mean, like, just call it by a different name. It still carries out the same function.
No. So, the reason it doesn't. And I'll tell you why. Because the restructuring of the INS, which was initially, you know, before what it is now, which is CIS, INS with the Immigration Naturalization Service. Now it's CIS, Citizenship Immigration Service. George Bush reorganized all of this under the Department of Homeland Security. Immigration was not, previous to 9/11, considered a security issue, first of all, not like the way we basically married the two after 9/11. And That's where ICE came from. So ICE's function as a law enforcement national security agency, they do function differently than the way we enforced border CBP before that. The raids, you know, those
kinds of things. And that's the thing, is like CBP takes care of a lot of the border patrol and handles a lot of border crossing. So if you're talking about only abolishing ICE, you also have to look at abolishing CBP in that case, which many Democrats would probably be advocating for, which is open borders.
Well, I don't think anybody's advocating for CBP. Obviously, you have to have some administrative process in the border for people entering. And I'm not also calling for abolishing ICE, but I do think it's important to take a step back and trying to answer the question of what do you do with streams of people who are fleeing violence south of our border, okay? I would suggest, as an immigration attorney, that there is a middle ground. Like, the problem is we keep getting presented with, like, this binary. Like, there's only two choices, either abolish ICE and dissolve the borders, or lock them all up. And those are not the two choices we have to choose from. There are a host of different administrative ways to deal with this. And one of those would be granting like a program like TPS. TPS is temporary protected status. It is something that's been around for a long time. We granted it to Haitians for many, many years who were Haitians got it for the earthquake. El Salvador had it because of their civil war. So TPS is granted to entire like groups of people or like entire, in some cases, nations. Basically, people who there is something happening there that is that doesn't qualify them for asylum necessarily, because with asylum, you have to show a very specific persecution to yourself versus a condition where you come from, that's just a generally unsafe condition. So if we establish like a TPS program for the people seeking asylum, which maybe they don't actually qualify for in this situation, but they certainly are still fleeing gang violence and some really terrible conditions, the TPS would give them some temporary protection. Then under TPS, number one, we would know, you know, the government would know where they are. They're registered, they're legal, they pay taxes. They're not hiding in the shadows. They can renew it. If their country conditions improve, they can go back. I mean, that is a much better solution than detaining them, which is costing us ridiculous amounts. I think I read it was like $700 a day. Okay. And there are private prisons right now minting money off of these detention centers. So a better solution is to say, you know what? They don't need ankle bracelets. They just need some kind of a status that will, because I will tell you this, when somebody is an immigrant, they come out of the shadows and stay out of the shadows when they have some kind of status and work authorization, because they know in order to keep that work authorization, they have to, you know, they can't disappear. And they're almost all immigrants. That's exactly what they want. So TPS would be a perfect solution to this. I just don't know why legislatively it's not being discussed, you know, as a better measure. But part of the problem is that I think this administration, even with Trump's tweets and stuff, they keep saying stuff like that. Oh, they just want to dissolve the borders. They just want MS-13 to like, and who the hell ever heard of MS-13 before Trump? I mean, like as a threat, right? Nobody ever heard of MS-13.
I mean, I heard of MS-13 before Trump, but it was more or less just there were gangs that were.
It's like local crime, right? A local crime story.
Well, they're an international crime, you know, international criminal gang. And obviously, I think the first time I heard about them was maybe like 2014. And that was before Trump obviously ran, because he started running in 2015. But, you know, it was one of those things where like they were abusing the immigration system because we had this 2013, 2014 influx of unaccompanied minors as well as just immigrants in general coming in through the southern border. And you had these detention centers. And I can't recall what the reporting was like back then. And it wasn't a high focus on MS-13. And I don't think many people really knew about the threat then. And I understand that, like, you have to make sure that you're not letting those type of people come into the country illegally and being able to commit crime or have malicious intent against Americans. Like, I understand that's what the president's job is. I also understand that at the same time, he's probably making more people suffer for it who don't necessarily deserve.
But don't you think he is proposing solutions to a problem that doesn't exist? I'm not saying MS-13 doesn't exist. I'm not saying MS-13 is not responsible for crimes that happen in this country. But is it to the extent that he makes it sound like our... I mean, he tweeted something about ICE liberating cities from MS-13. What?
I mean, I don't think it's to that extent. Honestly, if Trump wanted to solve the immigration crisis right away, he would just build a wall. And it would cut like 98% of the type of border crossings that CBP and ICE are focusing on right now. If you wanted to talk about, obviously, you know, planes flying in with people who overstay their visas and are in the country illegally, then that's a different story. If you want to talk about people digging tunnels underneath whatever southern border wall, then that's another thing. Like, that's obviously cross that bridge when you get to it. I don't think Trump is being as serious about actually wanting to fix the issue of immigration. I never thought Democrats were very serious about fixing the issue of immigration, because if they did, they probably would have done something in 2009, in 2010, when they had a supermajority in the House and Senate. So, yeah, the immigration problem has never really gone away. It's definitely become more of an issue in the 2000s and 2010s. It just so happens that it's become more of a political issue and less so a policy issue that people actually want to solve it, and they only want to use it as an issue to win elections. And that's why I've become more and more discouraged by politicians who say they care about immigration and solving what, you know, getting comprehensive immigration reform, and they say like a Democrat is calling for it now under the age, while Trump is in office and there's a GOP controlled Congress, House and Senate, and they never call for it back when, you know, Obama was in office and the Democrats were running the show. It's just
I agree with you. I totally agree with you. I cannot disagree. I think one of the greatest disappointments of the Obama administration for me was the fact that he just left that hanging. He never.
And I like Obama. Like, I think he's a good person. But there's just so much idol worship happening in both sides that drives me up the wall. Because I don't think. I mean, when it comes to Trump, people just, you know, worship everything that comes out of his mouth. They love it. They, you know, every policy is a good policy. There's no, like, even with these people who are being hurt by his tariffs, they are still with him. Like, by and large, they're still, you know, still supportive of his policies. And it's like, can you at least, like, take a step back and, like, look at what they're actually doing?
Well, I wonder how they justify. I mean, I just read the other day that Trump is now going to withhold ACA payments that I think they were like the subsidies the federal government was giving to insurance companies to keep, you know, premiums and deductibles lower for folks enrolled in the ACA. So they're now going to withhold that, which is going to make premiums go up. It's going to make deductibles go up. And that's also going to hurt the folks like the middle class and the lower middle class who really just can't afford to deal with it. And when there's such a direct correlation between this guy's actions, this administration's actions, and what's happening in people's pockets, I don't understand how they can continue to be like, well, we still think he's, you know, to support him. I mean, or are they going to find a way to somehow keep blaming it on the Dems? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that's just politics. They're always going to blame the other side for why things aren't going their way. I mean, Trump has been blaming Democrats for the situation with immigration now, especially with the zero tolerance policy. He was blaming Democrats that they could end the policy now. And then he comes out like a week after, and this all happened in June. He came out a week after signing an executive order to stop the separation of families. Like, dude, you could have ended it day one as soon as you're getting the public backlash, and yet you chose not to. So, you know,
ending it, you could have like maybe not started it. The zero tolerance policy was him.
It was a policy he didn't even have to begin. And I understand that there has probably been a decrease of border crossings because of that policy. But I also don't expect undocumented immigrants who are traveling up through the southern border, whether they're coming from Central America or from Mexico, to get the 411 on what the Trump policy is.
But let's talk about two other classes of immigrants that is not impacted by this particular conversation, but certainly it's something we have to consider. One is this news that's come out that, I don't know if it's the DOJ, Trump, he's bringing together a task force of a new department. He's creating a new division of lawyers who are going to basically be a denaturalization force. Now, for folks who might not know, if you were born in the country, you're born a citizen. If you are not born in the United States, but then you become a citizen, you know, through the immigration process, you are naturalized. I am a naturalized citizen, okay? I was not born here. My parents are naturalized. This is, I mean, you know, in immigration, like in law school and stuff, and in immigration, like, you know, classes and stuff, you learn that denaturalization is a, like, it exists, right? But basically, it's almost never been exercised unless, like, somebody committed treason or something crazy. Like, it's just not a tool that's ever been used. And the fact that now what they're saying is they're going to reopen old naturalization cases to find any underlying reason to revoke citizenship and to deport people. This is really problematic.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it's problematic for you in particular.
It's problematic for me. I mean, and it's problematic for a lot of people because, once again, immigration is so discretionary. Like, you know, and it's these laws. I mean, once it has to be, like, litigated through the courts, and the courts, we're going to talk about, at the end of the day, he's going to win in the court when it gets to the Supreme Court. and the courts will decide like what the parameters are of like how they can review these cases and how they decide whether or not something somebody has a good or bad naturalization case. But, you know, I saw my dad last week and I was like, hey, dad, when you got to it, because I got naturalized with my parents. I was an infant. Like they came in, they were naturalized and I was as included. I was like, can you explain to me exactly why, how you did that? So can I get some paperwork? Because I don't have any. I just grew up a citizen. So I'm a little concerned. Are you naturalized or are you born here?
Oh, I was born here. I was born in Hartford, Connecticut. My dad's a naturalized citizen, so obviously he could, it would impact him.
Stop flashing your privilege.
This is too much white privilege right now.
A lot of white privilege. So there's a denaturalization task force, which is now being, I guess it's being developed. This is all, by the way, the mastermind. I mean, Stephen Miller is the mastermind behind all this shit. And then we get to a big bit of news, which is the Muslim ban, which was upheld recently by the Supreme Court of the United States. So, yeah, I'm going to hand it over to you, and let's talk about the Muslim ban.
I don't refer to it as a Muslim ban, just first off. I call it a travel ban, just to be a little bit more diplomatic. I know you're...
Travel ban for Muslims. Okay.
You're on the left-leaning side of things, so I'll give you the benefit of the doubt on that.
No, we can call it a travel ban for Muslims. Is that okay?
Well, the only reason I say it's not a Muslim ban is because it also impacts Venezuela and North Korea. And only 5 Muslim-majority countries, not every single Muslim-majority country, is affected by this. Yeah. Anyways, in a 5-4 ruling, the Supreme Court issued its first substantive ruling on the Trump administration policy upholding the travel ban. And this was in June, if you haven't heard. But basically gave the president more substantial power to regulate immigration. Chief Justice John Roberts, who is basically nominated by George W. Bush. He wrote the majority opinion and obviously joined by his 4 conservative colleagues, Justice Kennedy being one of them. So in Roberts' opinion, he wrote, quote, "The sole prerequisite set forth in federal law is that the president find that the entry of the covered aliens would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. The president has undoubtedly fulfilled that requirement here," end quote. Now, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who was nominated by President Obama, she kind of led the dissenting opinion, saying, quote, "A reasonable observer would conclude that the proclamation was motivated by anti-Muslim animus," end quote. Now, as I was saying before, the ban applies to 5 Muslim-majority countries, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen, and it also limits immigration from North Korea and Venezuela. Now, I will agree with Justice Sotomayor's dissent that it was the spirit of the travel ban was started by anti-Muslim animus in December of 2015 when President Trump, after the terrorist attack in San Bernardino, happened by 2...
That press conference.
Yeah. Right. He said, "I, Donald J. Trump, call for the complete and total shutdown of Muslims from entering the country until our elected officials or public officials can figure out what the hell is going on." Now, obviously, I was very much opposed to the idea of just banning Muslims outright. And I'm sure Rabia was too. Although Rabia has never been on the record about banning Muslims, so maybe she was for banning Muslims.
Just some Muslims.
I'm just kidding. I'm putting words in her mouth. I think what Trump has here is a watered-down Muslim ban. It's a travel ban, yes. It impacts 5 majority Muslim countries, all of which are either enemies of the United States or current combat zones. So you have Iran, which is an enemy, Syria, which is undergoing civil war right now, Libya, which is kind of undergoing civil war, Somalia, also the same as Libya and Syria, and then Yemen, which is under civil war but also being attacked by the Saudi coalition. So there's a lot of things going on right now. And then you have North Korea, obviously the communist regime, and Venezuela, another communist regime. Although I don't know why he still has North Korea on there, considering the fact how well his relationship with North Korea leader Kim Jong-un is going. But I understand the current negotiations are still ongoing with respect to denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. But Rabia, your thoughts.
So my thought, well, in North Korea this morning, you know, Trump put us all to ease by tweeting that, you know, nobody's got to worry. I got a contract and a handshake with Kim Jong-un. Like, we're good. We are good. You know, he's definitely going to denuclearize. So let's see how that goes. The reason the travel ban looks like it does right now is exactly what you just said, Siraj. It's because it's been watered down. He has had to modify it through litigation, right? Realizing it can't just be a ban on all Muslims. That is exactly what he wanted. But I will say this. What I'm mostly concerned about is the language of the opinion, which says that the prerequisite, the sole prerequisite set forth, is that the president find that the entry of the covered aliens would be detrimental to the interests of the U.S. That is so vague and broad. And now that this is precedent, now that this is the law of the land, I mean, you know, he can go back.
Well, it's not the law of the land. He only, what, imposed, what, a 90-day or 120-day ban?
Okay, but we are like a year out. I mean, like, are you, that's not, this opinion basically gives him a blank check. It doesn't say that it only covers the entry of the covered aliens for a temporary period. If he wants now, he can turn this into a permanent ban. If he wants now, he can expand it. Because if this is how the court has ruled, like, if this is the holding, like, this is like the legal foundation of the ruling, heck, I would argue that, okay, then under this, I can make it permanent. I can add other countries to the list because now it's detrimental. Now, I will say about the list, right? Okay, so Libya, I don't know. When's the last time Libya attacked us? Somalia, when's the last time Somalia attacked us? Yemen and Syria.
Benghazi, Rabia. Benghazi.
Okay, but come on. Okay. With Syria and Yemen, I think what's really tragic is that this means the complete shutdown of any refugees entering from these war-torn countries. And that's,
are you
really
sure it covers refugees, though?
It does. It absolutely does. It covers refugees, too. So there's no more refugees going to be coming from there, from those nations. No more Syrian refugees. Now, I am concerned that this is a broad enough holding that he can continue to broaden it. But I mean, like, it's a big win for him. It's a big win for him. And for once, he likes the courts, you know. He always hates the courts. He hates judges. He puts the word judges in quotes like it's a fake thing. I just want to move on to talk about, I think, one of the biggest stories of the week, of the 2 weeks, or maybe the entire administration, is the retirement of Justice Kennedy from the Supreme Court.
But yeah, President Trump on Monday night selected Brett Kavanaugh to be the next Supreme Court justice to replace Anthony Kennedy. Okay, so Brett Kavanaugh, who has the longest, probably the most extensive experience of any Supreme Court nominee, you know, he's been on the U.S. Court of Appeals since 2006 under George W. Bush. He was on the Ken Starr investigation into then President Bill Clinton with respect to focusing on Whitewater, and then Monica Lewinsky. He actually advocated for the impeachment of then Bill Clinton. So that might be a tough pill for Democrats to swallow right there. And I'm interested to see how Senate Democrats, particularly in red states and up for reelection, plan to vote. And I can't think of a better time for Republicans to be faced with this issue, because that may be the only reason why they continue to control the Senate, because a lot of these red state Democrats are simply on the fence. And if they sink the nomination of Kavanaugh, their careers are on the line.
Let me ask you, because you're in the trenches and you probably see a lot more than the average person does as a journalist. There were some weird reports that surfaced after Kennedy announced his retirement about why he announced, like, it was, I don't think this was expected.
I mean, like, anybody would want to retire at that age. Anyone would want to retire at 65. Like, I don't think there's a concern.
Ginsburg hanging in there, but I mean,
Ginsburg's
I'm talking
hanging
about
in there because she has to, because she knows that if she gets replaced with a conservative, then that's it. But Kennedy came in under Ronald Reagan. And so, I know people, a lot of people look at him as like a swing vote, but no, he came in as a conservative justice. So it's kind of tough for me to kind of see or at least stomach a like potential theory that he was pushed out. No, I think
not that he was pushed out, but that he stepped down in the face of some around the corner investigation about loans made to, do you know what I'm talking about? Like, his son is part of a bank.
I don't think
loans.
That's enough for him to step down. I think if he was truly worried about that, he probably would have ducked out probably before Trump actually came into office. or not came into office, but came maybe like the first, maybe in 2017. Like, I don't think he was compromised in any way. I think he ruled the way that he always has. It's always been on either conservative leaning or centrist. And then in cases like Obergefell v. Hodges, he sided with liberal justices. In cases like Kelo v. New London, he sided with the liberal justices in terms of government using eminent domain to get basically use private housing or residences and use it for private projects instead of for public. There are a lot of bad rulings that he's had, and there have been some good rulings he's had. But I think his legacy will be questioned by many on the left. And I mean, I don't think many people will celebrate him on the right, considering the fact that he was also one of the justices that prevented Roe v. Wade from getting basically sunk in 1992. Right. So,
well, I was going to say that I encourage, just for some fun, our listeners to follow an attorney by the name of Steve Klepper on Twitter, if you can find him. I think his handle is at Maryland Appeal Attorney. He tweeted last week when the announcement was made a poem he had written about, a sonnet in honor of Justice Kennedy. And I thought it was really kind of brilliant and also pretty on point about how he was not exactly an ideologue. I would say it's fair to say he wasn't an ideologue. You couldn't predict which way he was going to go on anything. But in terms of legacies, you know, Trump's greatest legacy really will be his Supreme Court nominees, his picks, the people. I mean, this.
That's the only reason why never Trumpers will stick with him is because of his Supreme Court picks. That's the only thing. That in Neil Gorsuch, a lot of folks who I've spoken to hate Trump, love Neil Gorsuch.
And I'm guessing this is going to happen. This is going to happen well before the midterms. I'm assuming they will get a confirmation before the midterms because they need something like that.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be a ride. All right.
All right. Well, that's it for this week, I think. There were some other stories that came up, but we are at the 1 hour mark or maybe beyond it. I don't know. And my children might spontaneously combust at this point. So I have to dip out. All right, Suraj, thanks for coming on this week and for bringing all your knowledge to us as you do every time you're on. My love to Ernie.
Oh, thank you. And my love to Mr. Bubbles. Or is it just Bubbles?
I don't even know who that is. You talking about Beans? It's Mr. Beans.
God.
It's
Beans,
good enough.
Bubbles.
I will.
My memory is shot. I will always refer to him as Mr. Bubbles from now on.
That's cool. So will I. It works. It works. All right. Take care. And listeners, we'll be back in 7 days. Have a good week.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345, and you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.